Victoria mentioned that that essentially we're doing a 4-week series, and I really love doing this. This is, I think, the first time that we've done it together here, at least with me in this role. And essentially, we're dealing with one subject, and we're having a chance to go deeply into it, and to do it in a kind of progressive and an integrated way. And we're doing homework between weeks for those of you who were here last week. And so there's actually been a really beautiful sharing of our experience as well. So I'd like to, just for people who have not been here for the previous 2 weeks, I'd like to just do a very quick summary of kind of where we've come. And then I'd like to ask us to share what has happened for us in this intervening week in terms of doing some practice, specific practice during the week. And then I'd like to sort of set up what might happen next week, over this next week. But I would like to say first, just to say that the only reason I'm here, the only real reason I'm here is because I want to support your freedom, your liberation. And anything that I can do to support your freeing yourself, I can't do it for you. I wish I had Tinkerbell's, you know, wand, and I could sprinkle Tinkerbell dust on you and you would be liberated. It would just be wonderful if we could do that, but it doesn't work that way. We have to do it for ourselves. So it's really my only role here is to kind of try to provide tools for freeing ourselves. And I'm really glad that we can do this. I'm moving toward retirement, and so it just each time we gather feels more precious to me because everything's impermanent. So I've taken the subject for this series, this little tiny subject of master your mind, from some very famous words of the Buddha. Probably among the most famous words of the Buddha, the first two verses of the Dhammapada, an anthology of the teachings of the Buddha that was put together many, many centuries ago. The Buddha said, "All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow." Again, you know, I mentioned in the instructions for the meditation sitting, that it's not what happens to us that is so significant. It's really how we respond to the world. We create our reality out of our minds. And there's another translation of the same passage that goes yet further and says, "With our minds we create the world." And if you look at it, if you really look at it, that's precisely what we're doing. Every building has been conceived in the human mind and then manifest. Every institution, you know, and there have been some wonderfully healthy institutions and there have been some really unhealthy institutions in this world, have been conceived by the mind, by human minds, and manifested. So we really create our reality by essentially by the stories that we tell ourselves. And so this really, what we're doing in this month is really, really taking a look at how we create our reality and then deciding what kind of reality we want to create. Do we want to create a reality that brings us a lot of pain and suffering? Or do we want to create a reality that brings us happiness and joy and touches others with happiness? And it's consequential from my perspective, it's really whether or not we master our minds is very consequential for us as individuals, but it's also consequential for us collectively. So Terry Thompson died today. And by the accounts that I've heard from people about his last weeks, is that he was really quite at peace with what was happening. He was not resisting. He was going with it. He was not suffering much in the dying process. I'll be going to visit in Santa Fe next Tuesday someone, Terry had brain cancer, someone who's in the last stages of dying of brain cancer. She said, could you bring me some peppermint tea? And, you know, I'll be bringing her peppermint tea, but I, you know, even before I see her, someone I know very well, who's been a really key person in the Santa Fe Vipassana Sangha, I said, how are you doing? How are you doing with this? And she said, I am just fine. And I could tell from the tone of her voice, she was not faking it. She is just fine, you know, in the last stages of dying. And many of you heard me speak a year and a half ago about my going to talk to a 21-year-old man who was within days of dying of cancer. You know, I went to actually plan his memorial service with him, and he was absolutely fine with it. It amazed me. 21? You know, no resistance. So dying is just one piece of the reason why it might be useful for us to master our minds, but we all have to do it. And we don't know when we're going to be doing it, and it's really useful to do our homework before we get there. So for us as individuals, it's consequential, but I think collectively it's also really consequential. I feel personally, I may be wrong about this, but I feel personally that that it's basically up to this generation of people who are alive today. The fate of the earth is in the hands of this generation. And that could not be said of any previous generation in the history of the world. You know, we have power now that humans have never had before. And essentially, we now have the power in our hands either to preserve this earth or to destroy it. And we'll be making that decision, and we'll be making that decision out of our minds. Our minds will create the reality of destruction, or our minds will create the reality of preservation. You know, and if we would like to have humans following us over the centuries that come, you know, we're going to have to make that decision. It's going to be up to us. So either people will look back and say, thank heavens they chose to create a different reality from the one that had been going on for centuries, so that we could be here. Or there won't be anyone to think that. That may be extreme, but that's my sense of it. So it matters. It matters whether we master our minds or not. So what we've been doing, just a very quick summary, is that we've been talking about working with three different elements. You know, if we want to master our minds, essentially it has to do with paying very close attention to three things that are going on in every conscious moment of our lives and noticing how they influence each other, how they interact. One is body. Of being aware of our physical bodies. Lots of people rarely inhabit their bodies, actually, because they're lost in a story. I mean, we've all had that experience. It actually takes training our minds to actually inhabit this body and its experience. And there is enormous value in that. We've talked a lot about that. The first week we talked mostly about being aware of the body and anchoring or grounding all of our experience in awareness of the body. It's absolutely invaluable. And then last week, so what we did is I said, you know, spend a week developing awareness of the body and particularly awareness of the body in times that are really challenging for you. Last week, I suggested that we continue to be aware of our bodies. You know, this is a cumulative process here, but that we pay particular attention to our thoughts. You know, what are the stories that I quoted Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, a person is made up of the thoughts that they're thinking all day. It's that consequential. You know, what are the thoughts that we're thinking all day? And mostly we're so caught up in the content of the story that we don't notice that we're generating a reality. It's about stepping back and saying, what kind of stories are we telling ourselves and each other? What kind of stories would be useful? Because some of our stories are very destructive, and some of our stories are really liberating and wholesome. And then also suggesting that we step back and actually look at the process of thinking. You know, that is not so much to pay attention to the contents, but really notice, what is a thought? Where does it come from? Where does it go? You know, how much mass and color and weight does it have? How substantial is a thought? These things that run our world are about nothing. You know, they're so insubstantial if you step back and take a look at it. And then also the suggestion that essentially what happens when we're always engaged with our thinking, there's no problem with thinking. We're Homo sapiens. We think. These minds secrete thoughts in the same way that the liver secretes bile. It just happens. It's a secretion. It happens. But if essentially what happens is when we're totally engaged with our thinking, essentially thinking takes up the whole arena of consciousness and becomes our reality. And if we ever step away just a little bit from the thoughts, we can experience an immense reality which is not thought, that most of us never get to because we're, you know, just lost in the story. Hence what Krishnamurti said, life begins where thought ends. What does that really mean? What does it mean for you? You know, this is not just ideas. Is there a way of dropping into an experience which can actually be immense? Immense and whole and radiant. And what it means is almost as if, like, I'm just using a metaphor here, but actually I experience this, is that if you actually went through the space between the words, you know, there's space between the words. And actually, you know, the thoughts are just this big, held in a very vast space of what our mind actually is. But it means stepping away from the thought in order to experience that vastness and that clarity. So, physical body, paying attention to thought, and then the third of these three elements and how they interact with each other in such a complex and very interesting way is to pay attention to our emotions. And I'll kind of set us up for working with emotions in more detail later. But now I'd like to ask if there's anybody who was here last week who undertook the homework. You know, and basically the homework was continue to pay attention to the body, see if it's possible to ground your experience in awareness of the body, and to really work with thought. What's going on with thoughts? Anybody would like to share their experience from the last week? Or we can sit here in awkward silence. Yes, please.
Well, I did something unusual today. I drank some coffee. And I don't know about the rest of you. Some people seem to need it to kickstart their day. I work with a number of them. Coffee has a very heart-racing effect on me. So I rarely drink, but I do love the taste. My favorite ice cream. I had a little coffee. I always put a lot of milk with it. But I forgot that I was also meeting somebody for a coffee date to discuss a project. So I had a decaf latte. And I can tell you, my heart is still racing I'm experiencing the feeling of racing. Still. And so I've been experiencing it all day. And for me, that's a familiar experience without coffee when I would experience emotional mania and sort of getting way too ahead of myself. So the thought kept coming up. You know, it was just so familiar and I could, there. And yet, then I would just touch back, just step on, an inch back and go, oh, yeah, my body is having a coffee experience. It's a physical experience. And I bounced around at work, sort of from thing to thing, but was quite able to compose things that were effective, albeit with a date mistake. And have peace through my day, even though my body is not peaceful. And it was very interesting to note that this familiar thought and experience, you know, the story that goes with the body sensation, didn't really have much power over me and didn't seem particularly relevant. But I saw how drawn my mind was to familiar past thoughts.
So if I may just reflect back to you, what I'm hearing is that you had a caffeine effect. You were able to feel that in your body. Everything was hyper. But it didn't necessarily spill over into your mind. You were able to keep the mind clear because you were able to be with the physical experience. Is that right?
That's correct. And also my words weren't tumbling over each other when I was in communication with people. All kinds of other familiar behaviors.
Nice. Thank you. Thanks so much for that example. Anybody else? Please.
Yeah, my experience is a little bit unusual. After the talk last week, I took what you said and internalized it, and it goes into this realm of great big huge vehicles on the street, Dodge Ram Dualies and Hummers, and just these big gigantic vehicles that we have in our country. And the reason for that, it's old stuff because I come from Colorado, from the wilderness area of Colorado, and there's a deep sense within me of the environment, big, and I hate to see things destroying the environment. So I thought, after our talk, I thought, oh, Joe, just get over this, you know, just let it go, it's like flies, and just shoot away, and just let your thoughts be at peace, because they're going to be there forever, and just live with it. Okay, so I was fine. Until this afternoon, and then going to the post office right in front of the door is this big monster thing sitting there with some guy sitting in it with all the trimmings and the lights and, you know, and they brought it all back. And tried to get rid of it in my mind, and I still don't like him. And I know it's part of the universe, and I guess just be at peace with that, but it presses another button, a lower, deeper button.
Right.
So anyway, that's it. That's my experience.
If I could suggest, we actually, it's just about impossible to get rid of things. You know, so it's not so much about getting rid of them, it's just noticing how they're working. The Buddha said, in order to slay the dragon, you only have to name it. And so, essentially, what you're feeling is aversion, you know, anger. And so, if it's possible to see the thoughts, okay, those damn big machines, they're wrecking the world, that's the thought. And then if you can feel your way down underneath to the anger that's driving the thinking, and then feel the anger in your body. And if you can just be with it, without resisting it, it'll move through more quickly. And you'll notice that conditioning. You know, I agree with your analysis, those big machines are doing really destructive things. But it actually isn't, we're not contributing to the solution when we stay in our anger. And we can get beyond the anger, you know, by actually feeling it and allowing it to move through us. Does that make sense? And I just also want to say that you may not have gotten the news, but the Hummer died a couple of weeks ago. So may it rest in peace. There will be no more Hummers, and there are many, many, many used car lots that are full of Hummers that nobody wants. So they may not be there forever. I just say. Please.
I had an experience right before I came, which startled me because I was on my way to meditation, but I was playing a game with my daughter, who's about 15, and we had a history of having a lot of tension around homework, and we just push each other's buttons constantly, and I get anxious, and she, whatever. But tonight we were just playing a word game, and all of a sudden I got really angry, and she said, "What in the world happened to you? We were playing a game, and now," and I said, "You're doing the same thing that you do when we do the homework." And she said, "Why don't you just go?" But I realized that I do. I get it's the same. It's a trigger for me, and I was immediately defensive about something or upset about something. And we were just playing a word game, and she was able to see it. And it took her really getting upset with me for me to see it. But how do I break that? I would say I have moderate awareness, but it's not healthy.
So there are some things that are really deeply conditioned in us, so that it feels like, you know, the trigger happens and the response is pretty much automatic.
Yep.
But there's a way in which if you pay attention again and again and again to that response and notice its effect on your daughter, you know, and there's some point at which, especially, you know, so you're playing the word game, something happened, the anger came up. You know, if you can train yourself to come straight down into the body and say, "What does this feel like?" Because, you know, there's a story associated with the anger, and we get lost in the story. The story never helps. You know, it's the story is secondary. The anger in this situation is primary. The anger is causing the story. So you let the story go, you're with the feeling. And you're with the feeling in your body, it's unpleasant. So it's an unpleasant experience for you. If you allow the anger to move into language, it's an unpleasant experience for your daughter. And at some point, if we watch the process enough times, there's something in us that says, you know, I'm going to do it different.
How many times more do I have to watch?
I can't say, but I can say, if you're willing to stay with it,
I can see it.
These conditioning process can be deconditioned. The very deep conditioning takes a lot of patience and effort, but it can be done. I can just say for myself, you know, sometimes I get lost in the automatic response and it's there, but there are other times where I can say, "Oh, there's that one again." And I recognize it, but I don't have to run with it. It's still there, but I'm not running with it. I'm not identified with it, and therefore I'm not speaking or acting out of it. Thank you. Thanks for that example. Please.
I wasn't here. This is my first night here. So thank you, everyone, for allowing me to be here. But my experience happened Monday, and I have a friend of mine that is a real 9/11 or, you know, weird change of government conspiracy
type
thing. And I just don't go to that place of getting angry over that. And yet, on the other hand, she's very spiritual. And if you were to meet her, she'd be very spiritual. But me spending time with her alone, I hear a lot of the anger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've just come to a place in my life that it's almost like when you sit and continue to listen to people's anger, and as I'm speaking to you, this is touching me very deeply, it's almost as if I've been an enabler for years. And so we're sitting next to each other on bikes at the Y just Monday. And we're talking and laughing. Everything's great. And then all of a sudden she got upset because her son is possibly going to be joining the military. And, I mean, she got livid. Right, went from happy to love to happy, loving thoughts, saying happy, loving things, to, you know, just this anger, and I saw it in her face. It made me physically sick. And I mean, seriously, I went, God, I feel like I'm going to vomit. I mean, it's the first time that's ever happened to me. And I just looked at her and said, you know what? I don't want to listen to this anymore. And I walked and got off my bike, and the whole time I'm thinking, what, have I just been enabling this? And why? I mean, I've known her, one of my best friends, I guess. But I don't need that type of energy in my life. But still yet, a part of me, until earlier today, because I practiced Tibetan Buddhism as well, and kind of went through mental practice and I released some of that, I guess that regret I was feeling. But I don't feel that that's my place to feel regretful about that. And I just want to be able to tell myself it's okay to release that type of energy and these type of people in my life, because all it does is it affects my path. I mean, it's not like you just meet somebody and you want to work with them. It's on and on. And so that's what happened.
That's beautiful. Please, go ahead.
I'm just, I know the Buddhists say there's no word for guilt, so I'm not going to use that. The Tibetans do. They have no word for guilt. But regret, just kind of, you know, I mean, I don't want to feel bad about walking away from someone's anger. I don't feel like I should have to keep listening to that. And I'm finished.
I think that's I really like this example, because essentially it was your body that finally told you. You know, so you're saying that there's this enabling process has been going on for a long time. As long as you're just engaged on the level of mind, you don't discover what the toxin of this person's anger is doing to you until you get to the body and you feel, ooh. So I think that, you know, that your body was this ally that actually helped you to break a pattern. So this is a wonderful example. And if I could just suggest, you know, that there are just a couple of ways of working with, if you continue to relate to this friend who has this really deep pattern, so it's going to come up again. There's one thing that can be really helpful, and essentially it's empathy. You know, so very often we're angry and we speak out of our anger, but we don't acknowledge the anger. So it's going to be all about the government or all about the military or whatever, you know, whatever her particular story is. But she's not saying, I'm really angry. And so it can be so useful to help somebody to step out of their story by saying, are you feeling anger right now? Goddamn right I am, you know. But what we're doing? Oh, I see that you're feeling anger, and it must be painful.
Yes.
And it is painful.
It must be.
But we don't acknowledge that for each other. We don't acknowledge that we're feeling it. We don't acknowledge the pain of it. But if you were to be a gentle mirror again and again and again, oh, there's that anger again. Is it painful? You know, so, and then just one other thing, that's empathy. The other one, which can be really helpful, you know, if we're with people who have aspects of suffering that spill over to us, let's say. If it's possible to see that the anger is her anger, it's her process, it's her story.
Not collectivism.
Right, exactly.
So there's that whole thing that people, you know, spiritually, you know, I'm on different paths in my practice, but you know, scriptures say, well, that's a mirror image of you. And I'm like, I just totally disagree with that, you know, and some
There are layers and layers and layers here. So on one level, it's not, you know, allow her own process. She is not a self. She's actually a karmic stream, and that karmic stream has its own conditioning. Each being here is a unique karmic stream. Oh, there it goes. Lots of anger. So that way you're separating from it. On a deeper level, yes, if you've ever experienced anger, then she's a reflection of you on some level. But then there's the yet deeper level, and this is very hard for us until we really, really get it on a deep intuitive level. It's hard for us to do, but to realize there's no self there speaking, and there's no self here listening. And when that's happening, when you see it's only conditioning, then the hooks, it's much harder to get hooked. You know, when you think she is over there and she's harming me with her speech, you know, there's a she and a you, then it's out of that identification that so much of our her reactivity and then your reaction to her comes from. So, we could spend hours talking about this and we're just telegraphing it to each other, But there are all kinds of ways of working with it. I support you to walk away if you feel like you're being harmed by a situation. And at times you might choose to stay, but to work with it not in your habitual enabling way, but how else can I respond here? You know, with empathy, with whatever. So, thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Probably help worth a dollar as well.
No, I'm writing it down.
Did I see a hand over here? Please.
I'm Kathy. I went to the gas station after I left here, and it was about 8, I think, and a guy was lurking around my Jeep while I went in to pay. And I was just aware of him there. I wasn't scared or anything, and then he popped over on the other side, and I said, "What are you doing?" Because, he's getting a little too close, and I thought he might get in my Jeep. And I just stood there and watched him with no fear or anything. And then he turned around, started walking away slowly. And I waited to see till he finally was out of, you know, made sure he was across the street. And then I continued. But it was interesting how I spoke to him, and I wasn't afraid.
Wonderful. Wonderful. It takes a lot of clarity, you know, not to go to the habitual fear. And you were not threatening him. You were just saying, "What are you doing?" You know, so very skillful. Thank you. Thanks. And since I've been doing the homework too, I just wanted to share the experience that I had. You know, I've been doing this homework. I have, as many of you know, I have very severe post-traumatic stress disorder from a lot of trauma as a child. And one of the things that means is that I can't go to violent movies. Because there's something in this brain that can't tell the difference between fiction and reality. So I see the fiction as reality, and this whole body-mind responds in that way. So, you know, I may be one of the very few people in this society who's never seen any of the Godfather movies, for example. And most of the rest of the culture, because there's so much violence in the culture. Okay, that's the setup. Saturday, two friends and I decide, should we go and see Alice in Wonderland? And I said, well, it's Tim Burton, and you know, it may have some violence in it, and yet I'm a big fan of Lewis Carroll, and you know, as somebody mentioned, I have my degrees are in English literature, and so I was really interested. And so we looked it up on the web, got some sense about how much violence there is. And then the person selling the tickets was a boy who was maybe 16 or 17. He said, "Oh no, there's no real violence. It's like cartoon violence. Probably teenagers are not the best people to ask in these kinds of situations." So I go in, and I'm watching this thing. The above world, really dark characters and threatening, and then you go down the hole, and you know, if if wonder is rapture, which is a kind of delighted interest in our experience, this was not Wonderland, for those who, of you who have seen the movie. And essentially what was happening is I could feel this contraction in my mind. Mm. And last week, Mel mentioned recognizing for the first time the sense of impending doom, which can come for people with PTSD. And it was very useful because I remembered your words, Mel, on Saturday. You remembered your words from Thursday, and I thought, impending doom. You know, and I had to, you know, I was with two friends. I had to say, sorry, friends, I can't do this. And one friend chose to leave the theater with me, and the other one chose to stay to see the rest of the movie. But it was really interesting because, again, it was being with the body and seeing the body's contraction and response and all the stuff that was happening, the arousal that was coming from observing violence. It was being with the body and seeing its response that basically was a signal for me, you don't have to do this, you know. I can read Lewis Carroll. So just another, and I saw one more hand, so please.
I went to a concert last Sunday, a live concert of classical music and quartet, and it was really wonderful. And I hadn't been to a live concert in probably 15 years, and there's just no comparison between the recordings and the concerts. But I found it very interesting because I didn't have thoughts. You're just in the experience in a very unique kind of way. I had emotions, but they were not accompanied by thoughts. And the music would make me cry, and I would experience the tears, but without a story. Or it would make me feel just flooded with joy, and again, there was no story as to why I was feeling it. It was just a response. It was absolutely wonderful.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And were you able to bring your attention to your body as you were experiencing these things, to remember?
I did a few times. I brought it back to my breathing when I felt like I was just getting out of myself. But I kind of just went with the experience.
Great. Beautiful, thank you.
It's so wonderful to not have thoughts or stories.
Yeah, it's great. And it's really nice that you were able to see that, because you were able to be more present. What happens with the thinking process is it takes us out of the experience. Mm-hmm. And so you were there for the experience.
Yeah,
thanks for that.
I would have a thought.
Yeah.
And I'd say,
yeah, lovely. Thank you. Thanks for that example. So I'd like to, if I may, I'd like to introduce, we've talked about, you know, being with the body, being awareness of the body. We've talked about really working with thoughts and paying attention to our thought process. And I'd like now to set us up for the next week of being paying particular focus on our emotions. And again, this is an enormous subject, and I'm going to try to do it in less than 10 minutes, which is crazy. But actually what I'm about to share with you is the distillation of more than 30 years of really working on the subject. But before I do that, I want to step back for just a moment and talk about a kind of a larger aspect of this idea of mastering our minds. So, you know, we've been talking about this method, which is really valuable, of really seeing the interaction of body, thought, and emotion, and seeing how they work with each other. That's really valuable. But there's another way of seeing how we master our minds, which is deeper and, in fact, even truer. And that is that actually what happens with this process, the Buddha said, if you want to be free, if you want to be liberated, you only have to do one thing, really. He said, strengthen, support, cultivate the wholesome qualities of consciousness. The wholesome qualities of consciousness. You know, like loving kindness or generosity or forgiveness or patience or equanimity, wisdom, compassion. And he said, and reduce and eventually uproot the unwholesome qualities of consciousness, the afflictive qualities of consciousness that are pain and lead to more pain. Like like greed, grasping greed and anger and fear and envy and hatred and ignorance or delusion, confusion. He said, if we want to be free, do those things. And essentially what happens is that if we really do the full practice that the Buddha recommends to us in this tradition, you know, essentially it's a threefold practice. If we do the whole threefold practice, what happens is that automatically the wholesome states are strengthened and the afflictive states are reduced. That's what ultimately frees us and gives us mastery over our minds. If we stay in suffering because of the reactivity of our minds, as you reduce greed and aversion and delusion in the mind, the reaction just doesn't happen. And it doesn't even come up more and more. So if we focus on the practice of generosity, the practice of ethical conduct, of doing our best in our speech and our action to help and not to harm, and really make that a full practice. And if we do meditation and develop deep concentration, which is a very purifying quality, and eventually, and these are all absolutely integrated, eventually we develop wisdom and understand what is true and what is not true, then the mastery comes automatically. It doesn't require, you know, our having to do a complex method. So we're talking about the method, but I just wanted to mention the fact that ultimately the mastery comes from the purification of our consciousness. So to talk about the emotions, working these three things, of seeing the way, for example, and we've talked about this, but I just want to remind us, the way in which our emotions cause a thinking process. What we tend to do, especially if something is fairly challenging for us, what we tend to do all the time is that we're putting our attention out to some circumstances outside of ourselves, and we're basically putting most of our attention into a story about that thing outside of ourselves. When the really effective thing in terms of creating our reality and mastering our minds is what's going on here. And so what is required is to notice that there's a story running. And, in, you know, if it's something very dramatic, you know, so just for example, I know that there are friends of Terry Thompson here in the room. So your friend died today. You're going to be feeling strong feelings. You know, there's going to be something, there's going to be a grief process probably happening for you, right? You know, the fabric of our lives has been torn and it has to be re-knit. And so there has been this loss in your life. And so there can be the story about the loss, but the important thing is the grief that's running the story, if grief in fact is happening. Does this make sense? So the grief supports the story, and the story reinforces the grief, and the grief reinforces the story, and there's this cycle. We all know it, and it can be very repetitive. It can be obsessional. And so the most important thing we can do in terms of really working with our emotions is to uncouple the story from the emotion. Let the story go. Even if the story keeps coming back, it's just knowing, okay, the solution is not in telling myself the story. Even if it's a very powerful story, you just keep dropping it and you say, let me feel the emotion, let me feel this primary thing, the grief. And in order to feel it, it's important to feel it here in the body. So, you know, If you want to sum up this whole month of four meetings that we're doing about mastering the mind, three syllables, just feel it. Just feel it in your body. Just feel it. So when you're here, feeling the grief here in your body, there's a way in which, and you're uncoupling it from the story, then there's a way in which the grief actually has a chance to move through. You know, and then you can apply wisdom to it. You know, there are all kinds of other things that you can bring to it besides just feeling it. You can realize, okay, everything's impermanent. Everyone has to die. So someone died. You know, that understanding of impermanence. There are any number of things that we can do to kind of reinforce this experience. But the best way to allow the grief, which is afflictive, to move through us is not to reinforce it with the story. I am so sorry. I have lost my dear friend. How am I going to manage? I can't call my friend anymore because my friend is gone. Whatever the story is, you let the story go, you experience the grief. You experience the emotion for itself. So it's really working these three things. Seeing the thought process, being willing to be with the emotion or the mind state, and then feeling the mind state in the body, if that makes sense. So essentially what we can do, if we want to stay in pain and suffering, what we can do with, say, anger, if anger comes up, is run a story about it that reinforces it, you know, and it can go, we can support the anger. You know, I'm pissed off and I have I'm really justified in being pissed off and I'm going to stay pissed off. And, you know, you tell the story. You reinforce the anger, so we can either perpetuate the anger by supporting it, or we can perpetuate the anger by trying to get rid of it, by trying to suppress it, by trying to make it go away. You know, either you identify with it, or you repress it or suppress it. Both of those things feed the anger. The middle way, the real liberating way, is neither to reinforce it, nor to try to get rid of it, but simply to say, let me feel this, let me be with this, without resistance. And it will simply move through. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I said I would only speak for 10 minutes, so this is going to be very quick. But just in terms of our working with very dramatic and difficult situations. So this happens to us all in our lives. There are times when we're in some very difficult situation and there are very strong emotions that come up. And so I just want to suggest that there's a way, just some things, and again, it's taken me a long time to learn this. But if some very strong experience is happening for you, the most important thing you can do, the first thing that is important to do, is to contain it. That is, there has to be a way in which we can hold the experience so that we're not overwhelmed by it. So, for just one example, I once in my life, I had very, very severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was totally crazy with really severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I was about to go sit up on the mountain in the middle of winter and just sit there. And my partner at the time took me physically and shoved me into bed with all of our clothes on and held on through the night. Mm. And that saved my life. Mm. Do you see? So sometimes it's physically, we need to contain our experience physically. And in this case, I couldn't contain it. It was overwhelming. This mind was completely overwhelmed. So somebody else had to contain it for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's really important for us, because we're such individualists in this society. We think, okay, I can do it myself. You know, I can deal with overwhelming grief. I can deal with overwhelming terror. I can deal with overwhelming anxiety. I can deal with overwhelming depression. It's not true. There are times when we need others to help us to contain it. And it's really important for us to reach out and say, okay, I need help right now. So I have a whole network of friends that I have permission to call at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know? And they have permission from me to call at 2 o'clock in the morning if we need support. You know, and sometimes it's really important not to be there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and be in the middle of this horrible experience that sometimes happens to us at 3 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes it's important to reach out and say, can you help to hold this for me, with me? You know, so the container, there are many, many containers. You know, there's the container of our spiritual practice. There's the container of friendships. There's the container of psychotherapists. There's the container of our deepest purpose. You know, so sometimes when I'm really, really challenged in my life, I remember why I'm here. You know, I'm here to relieve the suffering of living beings. And so if I'm in terrible suffering, you know, the kind of self-absorption or solipsism, that self-centeredness that comes when we're really in suffering. And I remind myself, I'm here to relieve the suffering of living beings. And all of a sudden, I'm out of myself, and I'm with you. Does that make sense? That's containing it as well. So I think it's really important to have this idea that if something is very dramatic, it needs to be contained. And once it's contained in one way or another, we do our little practice that I've been talking about. It's not a little practice, this important practice of working with these three things, with the body, with the thoughts, with the emotions, and really working that. And then just one other thing. And I know that this doesn't happen often in our lives, but I know it happens to us all at times, and for some of us it happens more frequently than for others. But if there's some very powerful emotional experience happening, you know, you can use every technique you want, and it's still going to be there. And then it's important to realize, I just need to ride this out. So you find whatever you need in order to contain it, and then you ride it out. Because what the Buddha knew and what Western psychology is learning is that the mind and the body both want to come back into balance and health. Their natural state is balance and health. We get out of balance, but if we don't get in the way, you know, if we kind of step out of the way and let the process happen, eventually the mind and the body will find their own balance and find their own health. So it's really, and actually this is just, I realize it's such a simple idea, but it's actually been profound for me. Oh, okay, I just need to ride this storm out. You know, so get all the help I can, you know, seen beings and unseen beings, anybody, you know, I mentioned today, I'm a help slut when I need help. I'll take it from anywhere I can get it. And then it's just a question of riding it through. And we can do that, and eventually the system will come back into balance by itself. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the homework for this week is, you know, this is cumulative. Continue to work with awareness of the body. You know, continue to work with awareness of thoughts. Now bring particular attention to emotions and decide which of these emotions are useful for you to cultivate, like loving kindness or gratitude or generosity. You know, you're generous to a friend. It feels good to be generous to a friend. You know, you're compassionate to someone who's in difficulty. It feels good to be compassionate. You know, reinforcing those qualities. And then to notice, you know, when we're cruel, it doesn't feel good to feel cruel, to be cruel. You know, it doesn't feel good to blow somebody away with our anger, you know, with our angry speech or our angry action. You know, decide which of these emotions you want to cultivate and which of these emotions you want to stay with and allow them to pass away. You know, and then if something really dramatic happens, remember this idea of containment. This could save your life someday. You know, how do I contain this? Yes, quick.
I just wanted to do a quick example of that really helped to save my mom's life. I think my brother committed suicide about 20 years ago, and my other brother and I knew it, and we had found the news, and we had to tell them. And I said, I cannot call them, but I'll call their best friends. So I did that, and they came immediately over, and my parents both said, I don't know how I could have made it through the night without them there.
Yeah, and, nice, you know, wonderful.
That, but I still, I said, I can't tell them, but I can make sure that they're safe.
That's the container. Mm. Having their best friends there going through that horrific shock is the container. So, yeah, thank you for that example. So thank you, friends.
Thank you. Thank you.